The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Can change, and so that's why these things are in hours and not specifically it's this time and that time. You know, there's a lot of factors that we don't know here. Well, in 1974 in Texas was a different world.
In 1989, replying to a letter John Terrell sent the Fort Worth Police Department requesting access to Carla Walker's case files, criminal investigation captain Randy P. Eli states, "There are numerous inconsistencies between what Terrell alleges and the facts which have been documented and remembered by investigators handling the case." Delving into his files, it didn't take long to come to a similar conclusion. Before we revisit the autopsy report with another set of eyes, there are a few more details in John Terrell's files that I can't let go of. While we applaud his efforts to keep Carla Walker's case active, there is one event in particular that is especially disappointing. In January of 1992, John Terrell informed Doris Walker, Carla's mother, that evidence was set to be destroyed. Though it is impossible to speak for her, it is easily imaginable that this caused Miss Walker an immeasurable amount of alarm and emotional distress. She wasted no time alerting then-Fort Worth Police Chief Thomas R. Windham and then-Fort Worth Mayor Kay Granger that it was vehemently against her wishes to dispose of any and all evidence in her daughter's case. It isn't the fact that Terrell immediately informed Mrs. Walker that we find troubling. Informing the family of any activity regarding Carla's case is, from the outside, noble and loyal. Upon realizing that Terrell was, in his own words, acting on a rumor when doing so, however, makes the entire situation questionable. Where did the rumor originate? Couldn't Terrell substantiate or debunk the rumor without alerting the family, thus eliminating any emotional distress it might cause? Was there ever a rumor at all, or was it merely a tactic to stir the pot? If that's the case, it was an unacceptable way to do so. The Fort Worth Police Department did quickly respond to Mrs. Walker, reassuring her that they do not destroy evidence concerning unsolved homicides, a fact that seems expected, even to those outside of law enforcement. It's important to remember there have been homicide detectives whose lives and careers were partially defined by Carla Walker's abduction and murder. Detectives who were so affected by the case that it haunted and consumed them, even beyond retirement. Claude Davis, George Hudson, Jim Minter, to name a few. I received the same sentiment from Daryl Thompson when I spoke with him. Not only did he work Carla's case in the late 70s as a homicide detective, he was the patrolman who found her body in the culvert alongside Holiday Park Drive. It is also important to remember that at least two of these detectives looked into Terrell's suspect at his insistence. William Ted Wilhoit's method of operation was, presumably, a crucial factor in pre-DNA elimination as a person of interest. The crimes in which Wilhoit sexually assaulted his victims never included more than one individual, the individual being, of course, the person he singled out to attack. He broke into the victims' homes while they were away and waited for their return, or he gained their trust enough to let them in their homes to use the phone, for example, using pleasantries and small talk. William Ted Wilhoit operated in, perhaps, one of the most cowardly methods used by predators. Reports by Carla's boyfriend, Rodney McCoy, along with nearly every conceivable speculation as to how Carla's abduction took place, suggest that her abductor was extremely confident and audacious. This does not describe Terrell's suspect. Research into the Janelle Kirby case, a young TCU student Will Hoyt attempted to sexually assault, indicate that as she fought off her attacker's attempts to restrain her, she gained the upper hand in the struggle, and it was then that Will Hoyt panicked and shot the woman multiple times, including in the head and face. He further panicked, of course, and fled the scene. It is incredibly likely that William Ted Will Hoyt was neither confident enough or, it seems, strong enough to physically restrain fiery Carla Walker and fight off the very athletic Rodney McCoy. John Terrell never seems to consider method of operation speculation, though it is certainly telling. A former detective was quoted as telling Jeff Prince of the Fort Worth Weekly, "I'm surprised Terrell hasn't got Will Hoyt involved in the Kennedy assassination," referring to the notion that Terrell is so consumed with him that he's lost objectivity, Prince says. Aside from John Terrell's condensed investigation notes, which, as mentioned on the first part of this episode, read like a memoir and are at least somewhat compelling at times, little exists in his file that is mind-blowing or akin to a smoking gun. The results of Will Hoyt's lie detector test in February of 1976 are certainly interesting and raise questions. He was shown as deceptive when asked if he had any knowledge of Carla's abduction and murder. But the polygraph examiner makes a note at the end of his report that states, "This individual may have a serious emotional problem that is contributing to the erratic nature of the charts." It is also noted, which Terrell recognizes to his credit, that Will Hoyt was shown untruthful because he was concerned about another crime which he committed against a female that involved a weapon. This is no doubt referring to the attempted restraint and attempted sexual assault of Janelle Kirby, which resulted in the young woman being shot several times. Let's go back to the autopsy report. John Terrell was in possession of Carla's autopsy report, and it isn't negligent to assume that he did have, or could have had, access to the opinions of professionals. Nowhere in his notes, files, or investigation summary did he ever mention having the document interpreted by a medical examiner or any other individual who might provide him with potential clues in his probe into William Ted Will Hoyt. It is doubtful that anyone who has researched Carla's case will come to any other conclusion but that John Terrell is responsible for leaking the fact that Carla had morphine in her system to the press, leaving police with one less detail to confirm a tip or confession with. Though there are other details that can be confirmed that only the perpetrator or someone with direct knowledge would know, the morphine was certainly a big one. I spoke with Darren Dake, the founder of the Death Investigation Training Academy, hoping to shed some light on many details we had questions about in the report. Darren is an American Board of Medico-Legal Death Investigators accredited death investigator and an American College of Forensic Examiners certified criminal investigator. He has over 30 years' experience in the field of criminal law enforcement and death investigations, including working with the Crawford County, Missouri Sheriff's and Coroner's Offices, both for over 20 years. Darren is the lead instructor for the Death Investigation Training Academy and hosts a podcast called Coroner Talk that aids his students and even other death investigators. For the most part, I ask Darren the same questions I asked Grace Dukes, the forensic pathologist and medical examiner we talked to on part one of this episode. My talk with Darren was much more extensive than you will hear, unfortunately. We were asked by the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit to omit many parts of our conversation that they feel might hinder the investigation if the details were to be released to the public. Our original intent was to release Darren Dake's complete assessment of the report, along with all speculation, and we apologize to both Darren and our listeners for our inability to do so, though we do agree with the detective that the information should remain undisclosed. I asked Darren to explain the possibilities of the alcohol in Carla's system.
taking a blood alcohol level 3 days after someone has died can obviously change the level in the blood, because the body will produce ethanol after death. So certainly that level could have been raised simply from the decomposition. So I wouldn't put any specifics on that. Now, had she maybe been drinking before she went missing? Possibly. But I wouldn't put any weight into that 0.12. So, yes, it'll be considerably different 3 days later.
Both Grace Duke's and Darren's assertion is that the level of alcohol found in Carla's system reflects levels naturally created by the body after death. Darren went on to discuss the contents of Carla's stomach and what it might mean concerning the timeline.
If you eat a meal, the food is going to be completely out of your stomach in 2 to 3 hours. But again, understand everybody's different, but that's why we have a range of 2 to 3 hours. Obviously, a more starchy substance may break down differently than something else. Steak will take longer to break down, let's say, than mashed potatoes. But 2 to 3 hours, generally, all food will be out of the person's stomach. So there could be some other stuff that's liquefied in there, maybe some, so like you said, there were some small particles, some brown fluid. That was just what the stomach acid, you know, continued to dissolve. But it would have been in the small intestine, dissolved and in the small intestine within just a couple of hours. So we don't know when she died. We know she's been dead 2 or 3 days, but we don't know how long she died after her first meal. And if she was kidnapped or morphined or raped or anything else, it probably obviously would have been more than 2 or 3 hours prior to her being killed. And also, of course, if there's a lot of stress and a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety, you know, your stomach can produce a lot more acid, which can also speed up the digestive process. Again, we're within hours, we're within a time frame, nothing specific, but it would be very normal in this case for her stomach to be empty unless she was killed immediately after she ate or within just a little while after she ate.
Remember, Carla was found approximately 3 days and 18 hours after she was abducted. As Grace explained on part one of this episode, rigor mortis had completely released, indicating that the medical examiner, Felix Quotes, most likely made the right determination when approximating Carla's time of death 2 to 3 days prior to her body being found. Though Darren and Grace agree, we wanted to share Darren's opinion as well.
Rigor mortis starts immediately upon death, and it starts equally throughout the entire body, all the muscles in the body, because of the depletion of lactic acid. Now, we say in our industry that we can notice it first, like in the fingers and the jaws, but that's because the fingers and the jaw, they got smaller muscles, and so they're going to feel like the rigor mortis starts there. No, it starts everywhere at the same time. It's just by the time you would get to the leg muscles and stuff, of course, those are bigger muscles. See, that's why it seems to take longer. Also, we find that small children, infants and small children and elderly will go into rigor or full rigor faster because they have less muscle tone. So you take some 90-year-old lady that's just frail and barely moving around, she's got no jaw, skin and bones, well, she'll go into rigor pretty quick. There's very little muscle. You take someone that's, you know, bench pressing 560 pounds, big muscle man, it may take a little longer for his body to go into full rigor. But once the rigor gets completely set, then within 24 to 36 hours, that will start to release. Again, depending on the size of the person, depending on the weather. So obviously, the hot speeds things up, colder slows things down. And so I do know that we had different varying weather at that time, hotter in the day, colder at night. So with the absence of rigor mortis, if the investigation determined that she'd been dead 2 to 3 days, because a lot of times these are time frames, then her rigor mortis being released would be consistent with a 2 to 3 day time frame since death. So I would not be surprised to note that the rigor mortis had already been released. She was consistently, the rigor had been released. Now, the doctor only mentioned it in the lower extremities, but again, that's the bigger muscle. So if it's already releasing the bigger muscles, then obviously we're looking at 24 to more like 36 hours.
The cause of Carla's death isn't challenged by anyone, and certainly not by Darren Dake. But again, we find an explanation from a criminal investigator's point of view is necessary.
The weight of the lungs and the congestion of the lungs is, congestion is just the edema, and edema just builds up a fluid. So you've got a couple of factors here. One, decomposition does create fluid, purge fluid, they call, you know, you would call, right? if it's depressing her respiratory system to a point, then edema will start building up in your lungs. Edema is just water. And so that's why you have a lot of people in hospitals and older people who aren't taking very deep breaths and lay around, they get pneumonia. And pneumonia is liquid in the lungs. Well, and morphine, which is a depressant, it will depress your respiratory system. That can cause edema. So maybe some edema was caused from the morphine. Maybe some edema was caused from the being dead 2 or 3 days. That'll cause a heavier weight of lungs. Having congestion in the lungs is not abnormal with morphine present and being dead 3 days. Now, petechiae is a hemorrhage of the eyes, but what a petechiae is are small red dots in your eyes and the sclera of the eye, the white of the eye, and the lip. And it is caused from capillaries breaking on the surface of the eye. So what happens is when someone is being strangled, they're under a lot of pressure. Let's say they're stressed, they're fear, they're fighting, their blood pressure is up. The pressure is being built up in their head. And when that pressure is built up, you get all these little, for lack of a better term, balloons popping all over because they're so pressurized that they're starting to pop. That's what petechiae is. Now, it is an indication of a strangulation, but there are times that it's not seen, and there's times that it's seen when it's not a strangulation, but it's based upon pressure inside the head. So if in a hanging situation, let's say someone committed suicide, a lot of times in a suicide, the reason you don't see petechiae is because if I hang myself in a suicide, I've got a high ligature, goes underneath my lower jaw, behind my ears, and if I'm to one side or the other a little bit, I've occluded my arteries for the most part, but the returning veins aren't necessarily occluded, which means I have bled off some of my own pressure. Now, in a judicial hanging or in a rope strangulation, it goes all the way around their neck and tightens it down. Well, now I've occluded both arteries and veins a lot of times, so the pressure just builds up until all these little balloons start popping. So that's what petechiae is caused from. Isn't that it would not be seen if it was a throttling or a manual hand strangulation. It could be seen, but it would be awful hard. It would be a lot harder to use your hands to the point that you've created that much pressure. Again, it has happened. You'll find reports where that does happen. Well, what I read on the autopsy report, the injuries of the neck muscles was consistent with a strangulation. Now, the hyoid bone is many times fractured in a strangulation. That's one of the keys we look for. The hyoid bone is broke when there was downward pressure put on that hyoid bone and snapped it in half. But again, like everything else, there was a lot of factors.
That's as far as we can go with mine and Darren's conversation. And again, we apologize to both Darren and the listeners that we were unable to release the entirety of this conversation. We'd like to close this episode with a disclaimer of sorts. We've mentioned throughout parts 1 and 2 that while we have issues with John Terrell's work, we have no issues with his perseverance and dedication to Carla Walker's case. His obsession may have clouded his objectivity, but it was rooted in seeking justice for a family who needed answers, and he was unwilling to cave in his determination to find that justice. Beyond Carla's case, Terrell was reportedly an excellent burglary detective. His methods at performing that duty were arguably much more civilized than his homicide detective counterparts from the time. He didn't use excessive force or threats to coerce his suspects or detainees into submission. Burglary is admittedly a far cry from homicide, and burglars a far cry from murderers, but John Terrell was said to have treated those he arrested and detained with decency, hoping to be rewarded with their trust, the same trust he first placed in them. A fair shake, as Jeff Prince from the Fort Worth Weekly describes it, a method that Terrell claims he could clear more crimes with. Prince describes a couple of stories as examples in his article, Murder and Obsession. Terrell once gave a flashlight to a prisoner he was transporting one evening so that he could direct traffic around a wreck that the two happened upon. Prince also reports that Terrell once let a prisoner leave without filling out formal and necessary paperwork after being cleared of suspicion for the crime in which he was detained. This didn't sit kindly with the jailer, who was upset with Terrell, saying the forms needed to be completed and a thumbprint obtained. Apparently, John Terrell pressed his own thumb into the ink pad and stuck it to the form. Prince goes on to say that Terrell helped a heroin addict with his rehabilitation and that the individual kept up with the retired detective for over 20 years. Much to the detriment of his career, John Terrell was indeed something out of a detective magazine story, a cop who, in his own words, quote, did things a little different than a lot of them. I didn't put down the brass, but I didn't kiss their asses either. Have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Detectives at 817-392-4307. We've recently experienced a death in the family, so please bear with us. We'll be back as soon as possible with the story of a girl from Denton who touched so many lives in her short time on this earth. We'd like to thank Kathleen Barnett for sharing John Terrell's files with us, and Darren Dake for providing his experienced insight into the autopsy report. Some information included was taken from Jeff Prince's articles titled Murder and Obsession and A Mystery Reopened. You can find both on the web in Fort Worth Weekly's archives, and I highly recommend you do, as they're the most comprehensive pieces available on John Terrell's work concerning Carla Walker's case. We'd also like to thank Diane K., Kim S., and Cindy D.C. for their incredible and immense support. They have helped us with information and details that would likely have remained unknown if not for them. And of course, we'd like to give a huge thanks to the Walker family for their unwavering and continued support. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the cases we cover and post pictures, so please join in. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Carla's story with a friend, or stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. If you enjoy true crime, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. The True Crime Files is passionate about unsolved cases, handling them in rich detail, interesting insight, and respect to the victims. Trust us, you won't be disappointed. Also, if Texas true crime is your thing, then head over to cowtowncrime.com, where you'll find blog posts about many cases from the Dallas-Fort Worth area and podcast reviews as well. And finally, we'd like to present a promo for Swindled, a podcast about white-collar crime brought to you by a concerned citizen. It's quickly become one of our favorite podcasts, and we're sure y'all will feel the same. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hooker Chemical Corporation dumped over 80 toxic substances at Love Connect.
With the $53 million she stole from the city of Dixon, Illinois,
orchestrating the largest lotto scam ever.
White-collar and corporate crime is a worldwide epidemic. From simple embezzlements, frauds, con artists, and Ponzi schemes, to devastating environmental disasters and economic depressions, these financially motivated crimes have shaped our world in unimaginable ways, all in the name of greed. Swindled is a podcast that uses narrative storytelling, archival audio, and immersive soundscapes to explore these true cases of white-collar and corporate crime. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever else you may get your podcasts. For more information about the show, visit our website at swindledpodcast.com and connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @swindledpodcast.